Okay, now, this time, Off the Hook is ready to do a program. So, without further ado, stay tuned for Off the Hook here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
We're sorry. The number you have reached, 99.5 WBAI, is now off the hook.
Good evening to everybody. The program is finally off the hook. Welcome. And, just so you know, Kyle, you've been tearing your hair out.
I want to apologize. It's just blame me.
But it wasn't your fault.
Well, there's a little bit on my end, but I also want to thank everybody on the engineering end at the station for their patience and helping us.
And I don't know if you communicated. We're going to try and go a little longer so that we make up all the time we lost.
Yeah.
Maybe instead of 55 we're out, we'll be out at 58. How about that?
Okay.
Please don't cut us off over there. Trying to communicate. You guys, you don't talk on the phone. You text each other. Why do you do that?
Well,
you're having a technical crisis, and you're going type.
It was my
talking to somebody directly on the phone. Where did that skill go? Why don't we have that anymore?
A mistake I made. Also, the phone wasn't working quite the way I was expecting. The one that I was monitoring, but suffice it to say, it was a little bit of a back and forth.
It's a show about technology. You know that, right?
We've been off the air for a couple weeks.
This is our second show of the year. It's the second month of the year, but it's only our second show of the year.
Well, we got the cobwebs out, and hopefully it should be smooth sailing from here.
Joe Biden, you were supposed to make things better. What's going on? Oh, we have other people joining us. Hopefully I can do this without making a horrible noise. Let's see. Okay, looks like we have Alex. Is that Alex? Yeah, that's Alex.
It is I. Good evening, everyone.
Look at you. Wow. Okay, welcome. And Rob T. Firefly?
Good evening.
How you doing?
Hanging in there.
All right. And Gila, is that you? I think I see you.
Greetings and salutations. Yes, it's me.
Awesome. Wow. Okay, so we're all together finally. Off the Hook, the show about how to do technology properly and get things working smoothly. You're listening to WBAI in New York, in case that didn't become obvious. We are here to talk about the latest in hacking and privacy issues and things like that. Actually, could I take a moment and just kvetch about a few things? Because I've been kind of holding this in for the last 3 weeks. We haven't been on since before the inauguration. This is our first show after Trump, our first post-Trump show. Do you realize that?
Well, yeah, that happened.
Huh.
I was forgetting that.
But there are still problems, still quite a few problems, and problems that specific to me that I just would like to deal with. I've been going nuts trying to resolve situations now for, believe it or not, over a year. You remember a year or so ago, we went to a part of Quebec called Schefferville, which you get to by taking a train that's run by the native community. An amazing trip. We were hearing about this thing called the coronavirus that was spreading in China as we were going up there. It was just about a year ago.
Quite a road trip, too, in driving snow. It was incredible.
Yeah, you don't just go there. You have to, we went through Montreal and Quebec, which was great, but then you had to drive almost a full day from Quebec to a place called Sept-Îles. And it's in that particular community that I had an issue, because I booked a place for us to stay, and I went through this website you might have heard of called Hotels.com. And as is the case, when you go to hotels, even after booking with various online services, they ask for your credit card so that, you know, in case there are any incidentals or you trash the room or something like that, they have something to hold you accountable. So I did that when I went there, and lo and behold, when I got back and I checked my credit card statement, because that's what you should do, I noticed that I was billed by Hotels.com and by the hotel for the same stay. And for the whole last year, I have been emailing Hotels.com trying to get this fixed. They've been emailing me back saying, yes, we're having trouble contacting the hotel. They don't speak English. They're not responsive. And, you know, I've been so patient. And I'm wondering, how is this my problem that they can't communicate with one of their own clients? Now it's gotten to the stage, a year later, where I'm saying, okay, guys, come on, give me back, you know, my $70 or how much I spent to stay in this place, and just not getting any answers whatsoever. Alex, do you have a solution for me?
Perhaps.
All right, let's hear it.
I'm going to ask a series of questions here.
Oh, boy, the lawyer begins. Okay, go ahead.
Here we go.
Let me swear myself in.
When you booked the hotel,
mm-hmm.
did you use a credit card?
Yes, of course I did. What do you think, I paid cash over the Internet?
Well, sometimes you can make a reservation without using your credit card, like with a car reservation.
Yeah, that doesn't always work, but that's another story.
Right. When you went to the hotel, did you use the same credit card?
I'm not sure if it's the same credit card. It might have been a different variation, like, you know, under the same credit card company, but a different credit card, maybe.
And did the hotel and hotels.com
mm-hmm.
charge the same credit card?
You just asked me that. And I said, I'm not sure it was the same credit card. What?
Hotels.com and the physical hotel itself billed the same card.
Okay, for the third time, I don't know for sure if it... Wow, I feel like I'm on the stand. I don't know for sure if it was the same credit card. It might have been a different credit card, but it could have been... I think Rob just dove out. It could have been two credit cards run by the same company, you know, as in... I'm not going to name credit card companies because then I'm... giving them free publicity. But okay. You know what I'm talking about.
Have you paid the balance on these charges, or are they still outstanding?
It's January of 2020. What do you think? You think I have an outstanding balance for over a year?
Well, look, under the Truth in Lending Act, if you don't pay the balance of your card and it's still on your card, then you can put the charge into dispute with the credit card company, and it becomes their problem. You shift the burden by not paying the actual balance.
Okay, you're telling me something... well over a year after it happened, that what I should have done. And I'm not sure that would have worked anyway.
Well, this is the first time you asked.
Well, okay.
You can ask for advice if you want, if you need it.
I am a hostile witness. I really feel that right now.
yes.
I haven't gotten to my second. I have four different things to get off my chest here, and it's going to take long for each one. Okay, the second one is Network Solutions. Now, for some reason, I have been billed for something called professional email, and it happens every year. They bill me for this, and I contact them, and I say, stop billing me for this, and I don't get responses. And, I'm pretty busy, so I don't have time to constantly follow up. I emailed their support line, support@networksolutions.com. Guess what I just discovered prior to airtime? support@networksolutions.com. doesn't answer. It's one of those email addresses where they say, if you look at the very bottom, they say, don't send mail to this address because it's not an address that receives mail. So all this time I've been emailing something called support that is as unsupportive as you could possibly imagine. So I'm trying to get this auto charge taken off my card from Network Solutions, and what you have to do is you have to call them, but in order to call them, you have to wait online. It's going to take you a couple of hours probably. And I don't have time just to get a minor charge taken off my card. So year after year, they're billing me for something that they have no right to bill me for. And the other crazy thing about this, on that same trip up to Schefferville, I lost my credit card on the train to Montreal. So I had to change my credit card number. Network Solutions got very upset by that because when they were trying to bill me fraudulently last year, they didn't know my credit card number because it had changed. And I, you know, at the time I figured, this is good. I'm not going to tell them. They somehow found out my new credit card number because the bill showed up on my next statement, even though I had never told them my new credit card number. So somebody ratted me out at the credit card company, or they're just very good at guessing. Okay, you got something for me now, Alex?
Always. I mean, same type of thing. I mean, you can put this charge in dispute and then shift the burden, have your card issuer contact Network Solutions for some kind of justification that the charge is valid. You do that, it's also kind of annoying to them because you are making them spend the time instead of you spending the time trying to get, you know, a $7 charge or whatever the hell it is taken off your bill. But, you know, the corollary to this is I find somewhat fascinating, right? Because let's say, Emmanuel, you've got, $1 million under your desk right there right now, hypothetically. I know you've got close to that sitting there. I see the cash. I don't know where all that cash is coming from every week, but
it's counterfeit. It's counterfeit, but let's not get into that now.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about that off. Maybe I'm off the hook overtime or something when we're off the air, all right?
Yeah, we're not privy to the same rules.
Very, very good. But let's say, you know, somebody steals $1 million, mm-hmm. right? That it's worth trying to fight to get that back. It's worth throwing some money at that to go through legal process, to hire a lawyer, to make a claim for conversion, theft, fraud, whatever, right? It's worth fighting for $1 million to get it back. But if somebody steals $4.95 from you mm-hmm. every year or, you know, every month or whatever the hell it is, right? And it's a small amount of money. It's just not worth fighting for. It's not worth your time. This is what you said. So the way to steal a large amount of money and get away with it most of the time is by stealing a small amount of money from a large number of people.
Yeah, it's like skimming off a bank account, taking a fraction of a penny, nobody notices, and you have $1 million before you know it.
Well, that's true. Or charging $1.99 to 100 million of your customers
mm-hmm.
every year. Are all of them going to dispute that? You know, the vast majority of them are not going to do that. But this is why things like class actions were developed in the law, so that you could recoup that money, so that it made sense for lawyers to bring these types of actions against companies that were stealing small amounts of money or had, you know, questionable billing practices for small amounts of money dispersed over a large number of people. But for you to spend 4 or 5 hours to try to get this charge off your bill is just crazy. But if it has been dispersed over, let's say, 1,000, 10,000, maybe 100,000, maybe 1 million people, that Network Solutions is doing this to, possibly even more, given how many domain names for which they act as registrar. So, you know, maybe there is something.
I'm not saying they're intentionally going out fraudulently billing people. What I am saying is they're making it ridiculously hard to communicate about it. I can't even email them. I'm emailing an address that's called support, and it doesn't go anywhere. That is insane. I don't want to have to call them on the phone and spend a lot of time explaining the situation and then waiting for a resolution and hoping, crossing my fingers, that they're going to give me back the pittance that they're ripping me off for. These companies need to be accountable. You know, this conversation is already more than enough time that I want to spend on this particular issue. I'm sure our listeners agree with that. Let me just get quickly to the other issues that it's been driving me crazy. Some close friends have had some COVID issues. Been trying to get them some N95 masks or even KN95 masks, and I ordered some. I actually found a mainstream news article that pointed to a site and through Amazon, and I ordered this. And I paid for overnight shipping, and they gave me a tracking number. And 1 day went by. 2 days went by, 3 days went by. The tracking number in the USPS website said, we know about this tracking number, but it hasn't been given to us yet. It's called pre-receipt or pre-delivery or something like that. Okay, so, a week goes by. I've already paid for overnight shipping, and this thing hasn't even been received by the post office yet, let alone delivered to me. So now I'm complaining to Amazon. Amazon says, not our problem because this is a third party. We have nothing to do with that, even though we're the ones that build you. So you're going to have to try and work it out with them. And if you file a dispute and 2 days go by and they don't get back to you, then maybe we'll tell you some other way we can't help you. So I did that, and then I tried to post a review on the Amazon website about how, you know, when you order something, you generally assume that it's going to arrive. In this particular case, it doesn't, so don't fall for that. That was rejected because you can only review things that are products. You can't review something that you didn't get. So because they didn't send it to me, I couldn't review it, so I couldn't criticize them for not sending it to me. So that was frustrating. Then, one day, just suddenly, I received a notice from USPS saying, hey, your parcel is here, without any kind of tracking whatsoever up until that point. So USPS kind of joined in on this by not actually updating me at any stage except when it was received. It was still a week later. I still paid for overnight shipping, and it's quite possible these masks are counterfeit because that's what everybody who is posting reviews seems to be saying. But it was recommended by a mainstream news site, and I just kind of, you know, fell for it, I guess. So that's a bit annoying. And the final complaint I have is from my own phone. I get spam constantly from Samsung because it's a Samsung phone. They're always trying to sell me the new phone. And, I get these pictures, and it's just so annoying, and you can't stop it. And now my phone is complaining to me, saying that Galaxy Store is using battery. That's the Samsung store. It's complaining to me that this app is draining my battery. So I'm trying to get rid of the app, but you can't get rid of that app because it's Samsung's app. So it's stuck there. I'm stuck having my battery drained from an app that's sending me spam that I don't want to receive. Samsung, why would I ever buy another phone from you? Explain that to me. Okay, I'm done. I feel better.
I don't really have much
good.
To offer in form of advice for that one, Manuel. But you know, I think, you know, based on the last two, you should just give up.
Oh, no, you never give up. No, the important thing is to vent. The important thing is to not listen to people who tell you don't complain. Complaining is good. No, complaining does a lot of good. It really does.
It does. It's somewhat cathartic, absolutely.
I've had some similar complaints about apps that are not removable under the default OS.
Are you going to complain now, Kyle?
Well, I find that is really irritating, and I think this is something that maybe when you're customizing the packages on your phone, or you're rooting it, or otherwise modifying the operating system, I guess that's one of the perks of doing that, where you can get around software that's otherwise kind of baked in and doesn't seem like it can be removed, because if anything, you know, if we've learned anything in discussions here, it's that none of this is really set. It's just they want it to be that difficult. They want it to be a window into selling you more products, and using your own data to do that. They're you know, using a resource that you pay dearly for to send you those images and that content. So certainly it seems to me that you shouldn't have to change the OS or be in some developer mode or something just to have control over the software on a cellular phone. And that is one of the distinctions between these operating systems and the way they're integrated and the way you're supposed to use them. And like a general computer, like a Linux distribution or other operating system that allows you a lot more freedom.
Very true. Very true. Rob, go ahead.
Well, you know, part of the deal about choosing Android as a platform is it's supposed to ostensibly be an open platform in the sense that it's based on Linux. Anybody can develop for it and so on and so on. But Samsung, it's been a long time since I had a Samsung phone, and it's precisely because of this behavior of theirs. They're basically like the Apple of Android, where they want to lock things down. They want to use the platform to get their own junk to you over letting you just use your own device the way you wanted to. And, I abandoned that brand hard. But I think you mentioned alternative OSs, and I think projects like Lineage OS that are open and free operating systems for smartphones, I think they pretty well support the Samsung line. So it might be something to look at.
So it would work on the hardware, but you could easily jettison the sort of OEM stuff that they bundle with it when you buy it new.
Mm. Well, I'm not a big fan of constantly buying phones. They're immensely expensive. They're great. They do amazing things. But people are shelling out more than $1,000 for new phones. It's crazy. It's crazy. You should be able to make technology last longer and use things for many years and build upon those things before replacing them entirely. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Emmanuel. And the phone rat race, I feel like, was at its height when the iPhone 6 came out. When was that? Back in 2014,
How many iPhones are there now? What are they up to?
I don't even know.
12? The fact that we all know this. The fact that we all know this is part of the problem. But everybody I know who has an iPhone has bought every single one of them. What does that say about the quality of the product?
Well, it is ridiculous to do that. I mean, I had an issue with my phone, you know, right at the outset of Hope this year. In fact, you know, for readers of the magazine, I wrote a column about this. You know, I guess it was a summer column that became the fall issue, whatever that was. Anyhow,
you use an iPhone?
I do, yeah.
Oh. No, yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead. Continue. Sit back.
But I had the iPhone 8 Plus and then had to upgrade, at that particular time. And it was such a frustrating situation for me because the screen had cracked. I needed a phone. I had really tried not to upgrade my phone for so long because I was so sick of the phone rat race, and it worked perfectly fine for me. So I didn't need a new phone. It was secure. The hardware was supported. But finally, I had to go get a new phone. They wanted to charge me well over $1,000 for it. And then finally, when I went in the middle of this pandemic to a store, a mall, so a store within a store, a space within a space, to get this new iPhone, they then tell me we only have 64 gig versions here. We don't have anything higher than that. Anything that you have to order online. So, well, then why the hell did you tell me to come down to the store? And I'm waiting in there, 20 minutes with this mask on, and there's some family with 12 different issues and 17 different phones ahead of me, and I'm sitting there sweating. At any event, I ordered the phone, but I felt like I got really, really ripped off. At that point, for spending over $1,000 for a new device that I didn't want. And then on my way back, driving back from this mall, I said, this is ridiculous. I'm going to see if there's someplace I can just fix the screen. And I found a service that actually was able to fix the screen. And they came to my place here in the Poconos in the middle of this pandemic and did it without leaving their car. I just handed them the phone. They fixed the phone in the driveway, gave it back to me, and then I could cancel the order. But, canceling the order became a huge, huge ordeal with T-Mobile, and that was really what sparked me to write that column for the magazine. It's extraordinarily frustrating. This whole notion of having to get a new phone and being locked into it is ridiculous.
It's great to be able to complain like this. We fill the whole hour. Folks, if you want to complain about something, you can call us at 8 o'clock. We'll be doing overtime on YouTube, the YouTube channel called Channel 2600, one word. It starts at 8 o'clock. Our phone number is 802-321-HACK. It's 802-321-4225. Don't call it now. Call it after 8 o'clock, and we'll put you on the air, I guess, in quotes, because it's not over the radio, but it's over the Internet, and it's also archived. Go ahead, Gila.
Oh, I was just going to say, I am also an iPhone user.
Oh.
Sorry to say.
I didn't know that either.
I know.
Hi,
Gila.
Like,
wow.
Respect for me. Thank you, Kyle. But I'm also just going to complain a little bit. My phone, I bought it through my phone provider. I have two payments left, and it is now beginning to act up in a very significant way.
It knows. It knows.
I know it knows. And it's fascinating and frustrating. But the thing I was going to say about the apps is I am not clever enough to jailbreak anything on my phone, but what I did do was create a folder and hid everything that came preloaded on my phone into it, so I never touch it. I just hid everything. So I'm never tempted to use any of those apps.
That's smart. That is smart.
Yeah, you got to...
On the other hand, they're hidden in a folder, but if one of them decides it wants to start using your battery a lot, like the Samsung store, then it's still going to be doing that.
No, for sure, but at least I can remind myself that, like, I don't want to use Apple Maps. I want to use a different map app. And I'm not tempted to use Apple Maps, which is not good. but the app, not the fact that I don't want to use it, just to clarify.
All right. Well, I think we've gotten a lot of this out of our systems. I do want to focus some attention on the Parler story. We've talked about it a little bit before, but this is really kind of inspirational. Parler being the so-called free speech site where all the conservatives ran off to. Not really that much of a free speech site. I registered an account there. I know other people who did, and it was almost immediately deleted without us saying anything, apparently just because of who we are. So to call it something where free speech reigns, no, it's just basically a site where you might feel safe doing things that aren't allowed on other sites that have rules. So Parler was basically kicked off the cloud. It feels good to say that. And basically, do they have a home? Are they up? I haven't checked. Does anybody know?
I think they're up-ish.
Uh-huh.
I think there's some sort of Russian component to it, as far as I understand.
All right.
And what's that scary man, Robert Monster? Was that his name?
Oh, the guy. Yeah, that we talked about this. The guy whose name is actually Monster.
He's the CEO of Epic, which is a registrar.
That was in Washington State, right? Okay. Well, anyway, the point is they basically couldn't have handled it any worse. Once they were deplatformed by AWS, Amazon Web Services, Google, Apple, they were basically erased off the network. But then a lot of their information suddenly became available. 56.7 terabytes of data just magically started to appear. Now, quick thinking of a self-described hacker by the name of Donk Enby and a host of amateur data hoarders preserved most of that data and have been using it to piece together what happened on January 6th and the weeks and months leading up to it. Now, Donk Enby was able to scrape and capture and archive nearly the entire content of the website after it became clear that hundreds of Trump supporters had uploaded potentially incriminating photos and videos of themselves to the platform, many filming from inside the Capitol itself. Now, when news of Donk Enby's archival efforts broke, several viral tweets, Reddit posts, and Facebook posts claimed that she had captured private information, scans of driver's licenses and IDs and other highly sensitive information. She said those posts are not at all accurate. Everything we grabbed was publicly available on the web. We just made a permanent public snapshot of it. Very Jason Scottish of you. Nevertheless, with the FBI, state and local law enforcement, and open source investigators, looking for media from the attack on January 6th, the archive could be highly useful to a whole host of people. She says, I hope that it can be used to hold people accountable and to prevent more death. I think people should be allowed to have their own opinion as long as they can act civilized. And on Wednesday, we saw what can happen if they don't, Wednesday, January 6th. Yes, Gila, what do you think of this?
Well, there's that, but there's also been a really recent development with Parler. I actually found out about it about 5 to 10 minutes before we were supposed to go on the air, and I asked Rob to share it with everybody because he's got a computer. But the CEO of Parler has been fired. That news broke about an hour and a half ago.
So is that a good thing for him or a bad thing for him?
Unclear. He said the board decided to immediately terminate my position as CEO of Parler. He wrote a memo to the staff. His name is John Matzie. I don't know how that's pronounced. Matzie, either way. He's blaming Rebecca Mercer, who is the chair of the board.
His last name is Matzie? What is that?
M-A-T-Z-E.
What does that rhyme with? Interesting. You can't write this stuff, can you? You really can't.
No. So it's things are obviously still developing there, and apparently he's saying that he was pushing for freer speech than the board was willing to permit. Is I think the way he's trying to spin it.
Uh huh. And I'm sure that means a lot of Marjorie Taylor Greene type things being.
I can only imagine. Yes.
Well, I see this as a save by the investors to try to say that the activity that this led to was an anomaly, right? This is a way to, like, save face. Okay, we're going to temper the activity, and it's basically a PR strategy to make the investors seem like this is not what they condone, even though we know it is, and that they that it just simply got out of control, and that they're taking steps now. Of course, you know, the most irksome phrase, taking steps. Of course, Facebook was led to take steps forever without accountability, and this is much the same thing. Doesn't it just protect the board? I don't know, Alex, maybe you would have a insight?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, you know, it's an interesting development for Parler, but, you know, the CEO making these statements going, you know, over and over again, he had nothing to do with this decision. Well, of course not. You got fired. The board fired you. You work for the board as a CEO. I mean, that's the way it goes. Frankly, I'm surprised at two things. Number one, that they didn't fire him sooner. And in fact, immediately after the insurrection that a lot of this chatter had supposedly sparked on January 6th, or on or around January 6th. And number two, why he didn't resign. I mean, it would have been a much more dignified exit for somebody who had been fighting these battles over content moderation, over free speech, saying he spent countless hours working with the board. And then he suffered this really embarrassing issue. And, you know, look, the buck has to stop somewhere. And, you know, sometimes, you know, what rolls uphill, as it should. And what happened with these Internet archivists, the open source investigators, having the ability to completely snapshot Parler, as there was this cascading failure of security features, first with Twilio and then, you know, Amazon AWS about to take them offline. They had no authentication in place. They had this idiotic or this sort of monument to stupidity system whereby every single post was iterated by the number one, meaning that all you had to do was increment by one, like the name, the number of the thread or the number of the post, so that you could archive everything.
Wow.
All of these are gigantic failures for a CEO running what is ostensibly a security-focused and privacy-focused free speech platform.
That would have been a failure back in the 1980s. That would have been a failure back then. And, you know, in 2020, to have that kind of failure, it's unforgivable.
Well, they were off to the races. Yeah. They had their growth. And so why care? You know, why scrutinize it? Who's going to look? Well, turns out
we're all going to look.
When things go wrong, it wow. matters.
Well, you know, before we move on, if I could make one further point to bounce off something Gila had mentioned mm-hmm. earlier. And I think it also goes to your question and endpoint as well, Kyle. As if you look at Parler now as it stands, and I just looked at all of the DNS data for this particular site, and this is something I've been watching for several weeks now as they were taken offline and tried to find a new host. So we'll get a little bit technical here for those who like the technical talk on our show. If you look at the host right now, the host, the IP address of Parler.com, it's a company by the name of DDoS Guard Corporation. The IP address is 190.115.31.151. That's an IP address that's located in, guess.
Turkmenistan.
Take a guess. Well, close. Belize.
Tajikistan.
Right?
Wait, what'd you say?
So, Belize. It's
Belize.
Actually located in Belize. But this company, DDoS Guard, which is the host who owns that IP address and assigned it to Parler, DDoS Guard is a really interesting animal. It's rather curious. It's a host platform that operates very similar to Cloudflare in that it's a content distribution network. It prevents you from being DDoSed, right, from suffering a distributed denial of service attack. But it's rather strange because it's a hosting platform with an address in Edinburgh in Scotland, and it has telephone numbers that ring to Russia and ring to the Netherlands. As we mentioned, the IP that DDoS Guard assigned is actually located in Belize. The abuse contact details for that IP address actually relate to a physical location in Ecuador and an email address in Russia. DDoS Guard itself has two languages on its website, Russian and English, and the domain name registration for DDoS Guard site actually links back to Russia as well. It was created in 2011 with the Russian domain name registrar, reg.ru. So another rather curious decision was made by Parler.
Oh, boy.
Probably because they couldn't find anybody else to pick up the tab for their services or anybody to even treat them as a client that would take their money. after the insurrection that happened, that they went with this company that's located in Russia. Now, that raises so many problems, so many issues. I mean, obviously, the connection to Russia is a big red flag. You know, no pun intended. I know somebody was going to mention that, Emmanuel.
You know they're not communist anymore. So the red thing doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, but
anymore.
They still do. They do.
Yeah, it's
they
red, white, and blue.
Affinity for red.
Yeah, their flag is red, white, and blue. So there you go. Rob, go ahead.
That's true. Well, like their word for beautiful, Krasivia, it comes from their word Krasny.
Okay, no time for Russian lessons. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah.
And we just got a shout out again, the excellent work by Dunk Enby. If you go to twitter.com/DONK_ENBY, her display name is Crash Override, which we also appreciate. But this project is ongoing, and even now as we speak, she's continuing to post archived information that people were making available that is just what the insurrectionists were willingly putting out there during all this. And it's a mess, and it's fascinating. And if you haven't checked it out, you have to have a look.
I want to thank people who have been combing through our archives and telling us interesting things. We had one listener who told us some Donald Trump references that were made on a different radio show back in 1991. I just want to play an excerpt from that because I found this really kind of interesting and a bit funny. Take a listen.
What, Morbus? Okay, all right, we got another Miss America bulletin, and we'll try to remember one more time. Donald Trump. Oh, okay. Wait, you want to talk about Donald Trump? Did you see the piece in the newspaper today about Donald Trump? It's disgusting. Donald Trump was seen in Kmart. He was seen shopping in Kmart with his wife, Ivana. Okay? Who cares? Who cares the fact that he's in Kmart with his wife shopping for his stupid kid? I don't care. Listen to this article on Newsday. We knew times were bad, but really, darlings, and they spell it the stupid way, we had no idea they were this bad. Yes, that stricken-looking couple is Donald Trump, erstwhile billionaire, and ex-wife Ivana shopping at a Kmart in Senatoga, Pennsylvania. How humiliating. It's been a hard year for the Donald. First, there is the divorce. Then, he had to give up the 282-foot yacht. Then he put the Taj Mahal into bankruptcy court, and now he's hitting the bargain basement. Next, we suppose that Martha Stewart will be wielding her hot glue gun at the plaza. The Trumps, according to a spokesperson, are not broke. They were just shopping for back-to-school supplies for their son, Donald Jr., 14, known to intimates as Donnie. Excuse me. Seems that Donnie is attending the Hill School, an exclusive boarding school in nearby Pottstown, which boasts alums the likes of Secretary of State James Baker, movie director Oliver Stone, and the son of World War II General George Patton. The Trumps drove him to school this week and stopped by Kmart on Wednesday to pick up the normal things that a child needs when he's starting school. Onlookers say the doting parents emerged pushing two shopping carts full of, among other things, sheets, comforters, shampoo, pencils, and a houseplant. Nothing fancy. The plant was, according to photographer John Strickler of the Pottstown Mercury, just a little plant and a little thing, you know, just a plant. And that's a quote. Strickler said he staked out the Kmart parking lot after getting a call from a tipster, one of our subscribers. Small towns are like that. But I never expected to find him. In yet another folksy touch, the Trumps personally loaded the stuff into the trunk of their dark blue Mercedes. Mary, they really went into detail on this. Mary Harakza, assistant store manager at the Kmart, said the Trumps shopped alone and were not accorded any special treatment. Harakza declined to say how much they spent, but she did say that Donald tried to pay by American Express and was politely turned down. We don't take American Express at this particular Kmart. And so he paid cash. What page do you think that was on, folks? 43, 57, 122? Page 3. Page 3 of Newsday. Hang your head in shame. Justice Thomas was on page 7 or something like that. Ah, yes. Donald Trump took ex-wife Ivana to Kmart, but this makes the AP, too. but took fiancé Marla Maples to the Miss America pageant. The couple had front row seats for the Miss America pageant in Atlantic City last night and appeared early in the national broadcast with hosts Reggie Philbin and Kathy Lee Gifford. Gifford noted that the couple announced their engagement on the host television show Live with Reggie and Kathy Lee. Who cares? At one point, Philbin pressed cash in Trump's hand, insisting that the owner of three casinos here stop bugging him. Trump and Maples smiled but didn't speak. Trump was a judge for the pageant's finals 2 years ago. And then they go into a story about the Kmart incident. Unbelievable. Unbelievable what the priorities here are. Okay, we're going to try Nazis again. See if we bought enough time there. Dialing for Nazis on brain damage.
Oh, boy. yeah, that was the name of the show, Brain Damage. But I love how even back in 1991, the logical segue after talking about Donald Trump is to see what the Nazis are up to. Wow. Thanks to the listener who brought that to our attention. And, yes, all of our radio shows can be found in the radio section of 2600.com. Oh, and exciting news, we're going to have a lot more audio being posted this year. We found a treasure trove of old material that we're processing right now.
Along with the voicemail segments, which at a
later working
date,
on that, too. We're working on that, too.
Exactly. More to share about those recordings
but
as well.
But that particular excerpt from the September 15, 1991 show, what did you guys think of that?
I mean, my thought on it immediately was that, you know, your penchant for complaining has only increased in 30 years here. I mean, I feel like you've gotten better and better at complaining, over time.
Well, that was a different radio station. That was a different radio station, but the complaining pretty much follows me wherever I go, so, yeah.
Yeah. As I thought it was great.
Rob?
My thought is I had a couple of friends who were writing for Newsday back around that time, and I think I want to call them and ask them what the deal was with it.
Yeah, I think maybe you should. Maybe you should. Now, sticking to that that topic somewhat, a website belonging to the Patriotic Brigade Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, an organization affiliated with the white supremacist Klan, I guess, was hacked by an anti-fascist Israeli organization exposing pictures, names, and personal information of many of the organization's members. While the website originally consisted of white supremacist imagery as well as a link to join them, the hack completely altered the entirety of the webpage. In an exclusive statement to the Jerusalem Post, the hackers identified themselves as an anti-fascist collective by the name Hayalim Almanim, which is Hebrew for anonymous soldiers. Yes. Wow, that's pretty awesome. I love this quote here. Our objective is to strike terror into the hearts of the enemies of humanity. I'm putting that on my wall. Neo-Nazi and other white supremacist groups believe that Jews have an all-seeing eye. Our desire is to make their fantasies a reality and exploit their conspiracy theories as a form of psychological warfare. We want them to know, wherever they are in the world, that we will find them and expose them. We will destroy their lives, and we will bathe in their tears and mock at the gnashing of their teeth. There is nowhere that is beyond our reach. The hack also revealed the supposed leader of the Patriotic Brigade, a Texas resident named Kevin James Smith. He's not the one that made the films, right?
No,
okay, I hope not. This included Smith's face, address, phone number, date of birth, both email addresses. Both? He has two. Wow. Proof he paid to operate the website and a link to his page on the Texas Public Sex Offender Registry, where he has a very prominent entry, apparently. The organization will also be giving updates of their activities via the Twitter account Justice_Jew, which told the Jerusalem Post it was acting as an information relay for Hayalim Almanim to draw attention to their activities and find operatives on location. And further updates will be given on their website, JewishAntifa.com. That's right, JewishAntifa.com. I love it. Stories like that give me a little bit of inspiration.
Gayla, how is this pronunciation there?
I'm sorry about the wincing, guys. Hayalim Almanim.
Okay, all right. Fair enough. Oh, I couldn't figure out how to pronounce Regis, apparently, in 1991.
Yeah, Reggie
Philbin? Well, I guess he wasn't a star then, at least not in my world.
New York treasure, Reggie Philbin?
No, the WBAI engineer let him know.
30 years from now, people will be laughing at the way we pronounce things. I'm sure of that. Maybe 30 minutes from now. Actually, 30 minutes from now, you can laugh to our faces by tuning into our YouTube channel, Channel 2600, and joining us on Off the Hook Overtime. Again, the phone number 802-321-4225, 802-321-HACK. And no, we're not in Vermont. It's just a Vermont area code that we happen to get to make the number spell something cool. There was a bit of panic, I guess, when Facebook signed everybody out the other Friday. People were thinking they were getting hacked, that their information was being stolen, that privacy settings were being reset. People were prompted to log back in. I'm surprised that people stay logged into Facebook, but I guess that's what most people do. I make a point of not being on Facebook and just logging in when I need to check something and then logging the hell out as quickly as I can. But apparently a couple of weeks ago, at the end of January, everyone's Facebook account was, everyone got booted and they had to log back in. And this is what they worry about. You're still logged in from all that period of time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is this on the website or on the app?
Both. I did not get logged out.
Well, apparently you're the queen of Facebook.
Apparently I am. It's good to know.
Well,
does that make you the king of Facebook?
That adds to the conspiracy, then, that this only happened to some people and not others.
Ooh.
Well, okay, but this is something that we can't deny. Apparently 84% of people post on social media every week. Is that true? Oh, wait, hold on a second. No, this is... I'm sorry, I should have read the first part. This is part of a survey of 4,000 professionals in the UK and US, and they found that 84% of them post on social media every week, with two-fifths, 42%, posting every day, openly sharing huge amounts of information about their hobbies, interests, relationships, and locations. Half share the names and pictures of their children. Almost three-quarters mention birthday celebrations, unknowingly giving away information that helps hackers and criminals, too, by the way, launch a successful social engineering or account takeover attack. It's not helped by the fact that 55% of people surveyed have public profiles on Facebook. Just 33% have set their Instagram accounts to private. An overwhelming 93% of workers also update their job status on social media, while 36% share information about their job. And while these posts may seem harmless, hackers and criminals will use this information to select their targets and method of attack. It's common sense. It really is. And basically, those out-of-office messages that you put on when you go on vacation, they give out information on how long you're going to be away, how long you're not going to be minding the store, not home, not at your desk, and all kinds of possibilities for social engineering and basically identity theft and other things are quite possible. Alex, I'm going to give you the last word because we are almost out of time, but we're back at 8 o'clock on overtime. Go ahead.
On both of those stories, you know, they're really two sides of the same coin. The latter story that you mentioned, people oversharing intimate details, hobbies, things like that on social media that give rise to a security issue is one thing, right? And the ironic thing is those very same people were the ones that were probably so incredibly skeptical that their Facebook login session had ended and they needed to re-log in. But on the other hand, the fact that they were skeptical, that they were concerned, and they did, you know, suspect that maybe this was some kind of phishing attempt or a credentials harvesting attempt means that people are thinking more. They're thinking about cybersecurity. We're doing our job. We're getting the word out there. I see that as actually a good thing.
All right. Write to us, oth@2600.com, and tell us what you think of the show. Any information you want to share with us, please feel free to send that on in. We were preempted last week. We weren't expecting to be preempted last week, but as a result of that, we won't be preempted as scheduled later in February, so we'll be on for a good period of time now. And we will be on in a couple of minutes, 8 o'clock, on youtube.com/channel2600. And you can call in at 802-321-4225 during that period of time. Otherwise, we will see you next week, 7 p.m. here on WBAI. Good night.